weapons. You know, like I give you a lot of philosophical questions, but you wouldn't have any interest in
it. Yeah.
Yes.
Back to reading the letters, so we want less detail.
Less detail?
Do we want like a more broad philosophical question?
Doesn't matter. Any question that bothers you. I mean, that's the question itself. What is a philosophical question?
I was noticing in the earlier in Shabbos, when Yosef reveals himself to the brothers,
right.
I mean, Yosef, how old is he? He's for a long time previously, he's been asking about his father. He knows his father is alive. Why is the child with that?
Right. Is this a philosophical question or a philosophical question? You want me to do that? I mean, does anyone want me to do it?
What do we learn from the fact that?
No, I understand that. But it's a good question. What? No. I think I gave a share on that. Maybe about a year ago. So what? How old are they? It's a very good question. Question is an excellent question. I gave a share on that about a year ago. On that question, how old are they? Why did he say that? How old are they? But. It's a good question, then we'll get back to it. But my other question was, that we were discussing before, is what is a philosophical question? Anybody want to address that?
Our
outlook on life is a philosophical question. Okay. Well, what exactly do you mean by your outlook on life? So it's a good way to put it. In other words, my question is, you have somebody that say, what is geometry? Somebody said, well, geometry is something that has to do with mathematics. Right? So, okay. I guess that's right. You know, but just because an answer is right doesn't mean that it's the right answer. You know, you could say something that's right. It's not necessarily incorrect. But it doesn't mean it's the right answer. The right answer is something which zeroes in on the matter. They say, what is geometry? It has something to do with mathematics. It's a subject that has something to do with mathematics. Yeah, it's true, it has to do with mathematics, but that really doesn't explain to you what geometry is. If I say geometry is something that has to do with figures, you see, then already, you know, I'm approaching it much more closely. So if I say, what is philosophy? I say, philosophy is something that has to do with an outlook on life. That's true, but isn't that... is that really, you know, it may be a correct answer, but is that really something that is zeroing in on what philosophy is? You know what I mean? No. Okay. Well, let me ask you a question. What is medicine? What is medicine?
Scientific.
What?
The science of healing.
Healing, right. Which pertains... to which part of me? Okay, now then I ask you, what is psychology? What is that? The science that has to do with the part of man that is his psyche, right? Okay, so now I ask you, what is philosophy? Philosophy is the only thing left. It's a science that has to do with man insofar as it's not physical, insofar as it's not psychology, and the only thing that's left after those two is really the soul of man. Right? There's an essence of man left after you take care of the physical and after you take care of the psychological. In other words, a person Because if there were nothing left, that would mean that all you need to be is healthy physically and healthy psychologically, and then your course would be determined, because there would be nothing else, because that would be it. But if you are healthy physically and also you don't have psychological problems, and then you have different ways of living, you see, and certain ways could be beneficial and certain ways could be harmful, then you're saying that man cannot be summed up as a physical or psychological being, so there must be something else in man, an area in man, something beyond the physical and beyond the psychological, which is of significance, because if he enters that world and enters it properly, he can benefit himself. If he enters it improperly, he can harm himself irreparably. So this has to be an area of life that has great significance. Philosophy is the subject that deals with that area of life. So how to live, anything that has to do with that area, in other words, the area of the soul. I don't mean the soul in a Christian sense, but I distorted idea of the soul. I mean the soul insofar as man's inner essence, something inside of us, which is our essence, which has to do with how we live and the decisions that we make in life. Whether to pursue what? That's not really psychological, but a person can be psychologically healthy. If it were psychological, then you have to say that if a person pursues a life of business, see, if it's all psychological, then there would be no room for anybody to make any decision unless the decision would reflect on their psychological health or psychological illness. You know what I mean? If everything were psychological, so then every decision would be able to reduce to if everything were only psychology, then there wouldn't be any important decisions that would be outside of the psychological realm of health or illness. Because you'd have to say that if everything is psychology, so then the whole goal is to be psychologically healthy. Right? So then that would mean that all decisions we make we just have to ask one question. Is this going to result in psychological health? Or is it going to result in psychological illness? If it's psychological health, then it's a good decision. Psychological illness, then it's a bad decision. And every decision can be reduced to that, because that's all there is. But if you say, if I could show you lifestyles, all right, which are equally psychologically healthy, but which will nevertheless result in different types of lives with different results, you see, then you can't say man is just a psychological thing. You know what I'm saying? So that's philosophy. As philosophy is the science that deals with life after, beyond the physical and beyond the psychological. In other words, a person can be psychologically, physically and psychologically healthy and spend his life in business. I can't say a person that spends, I know people that get up in the middle of the night and think of business, in terms of the business problems, okay? And I know people that spend their lives, they work from 9 to 5, and the rest of their life they spend with their family, they spend with watching television, they spend going to movies, they spend doing other things, right? I know people that spend their lives as professionals, as physicians, okay? And some of them can allocate a certain amount of time. But some people can be totally wrapped up in that kind of a life. Totally different, totally diverse kind of lives. Different types of lives. Different types of existences. And I know some rare people who can get up in the middle of the night and think about a problem in mathematics or a problem in Gemara. And their whole life is involved in this type of, in this world, in the world of thought. Okay, like the life of an Albert Einstein, the life of the Bully Gone, these are completely different lives, completely different. Nobody would say that one is psychologically more healthy than the other. No psychologist said, well, if you're in business, then you're psychologically healthy. But you don't have to. There's a book over there. There's a book over there on the lives of Nobel Prize winners. Under that first book. Thank you. Nobel laureates. Okay? It's a book on Nobel Prize winners in economics. But it's interesting. Why do they write books like that? Because most people don't have lives like that. They're very curious to see what kind of a life that is. What kind of an experience is that in life? You know? How does that stack up against my life? See, people are always interested. They want to see. Maybe that's a better life. People are interested in today, I mean the common people and the media, you know, people are interested in the lives of stars. That's a big thing. Life of a Hollywood star. Wow, that must be something. People are interested. Is that really a great life? Maybe if I had that life, I'd be much happier. And that's why people are looking around to see. You know, that's what sells the newspapers. That's what sells all these, papers, you know, that are, besides the New York Times, I mean, all these magazines that deal with these lifestyles of these various people. People magazine, these different things. Why does a People magazine sell? Because people are curious. They want to say, hey, this person has this kind of a life. What kind of a life is that? Maybe I should have been a politician. Maybe I should strive to be a politician. Maybe that's the life of it. You know? People are always curious, you know, it's about different people's lives. And this is not a matter of psychology, because if this was psychology, then a psychologist said, look, if you're a politician, that's extremely psychologically unhealthy. If you're a businessman, that's a healthy life. Or vice versa. Or they say, well, if you're a scientist, that's a healthy life, you know? But in terms of psychological or physical health, it doesn't make any difference. Can't say one lifestyle is physically or psychologically healthier. I mean, there are certain unhealthy lifestyles. You know, I mean, if a person's working in a mine, then they can get black lung. So that's physically an unhealthy life. But the medical professional says this is an unhealthy life. But to my knowledge, no psychologist ever said that if you engage in A, B, C, D, or E, that one indicates more psychological health than the other. So the moment you say that in terms of psychology, you can be equally healthy no matter what kind of a lifestyle you pursue, so that means, and yet you see people are curious about these different lifestyles, so they want to say, hey, maybe this is an area I should be in, you know? Maybe I'd be much happier as an artist. Maybe, what was Picasso's life like, you know? Maybe that's really what I should be doing. So these are not psychological questions anymore. So the mere fact, if you just take a look around you, and that mere fact will show you that there is an area of philosophy. So just looking around you in the world shows you. But there has to be something in there that is not the medical, not the psychological, something else, which people think is very significant. So people who think one is significant, we would be selling all these, you know, all these periodicals, all these in the journals, and all these magazines. You know? So the mere fact that it's so shows that people recognize there's a world of philosophy. Everybody recognizes philosophy. Everybody thinks philosophy. Well, you're going to be a philosopher. Wow, that's really something that's lose how many people are philosophers. Philosophers think of a person, wise. Beard and thinker, you know, this is a remote kind of existence. But the truth of the matter is, nothing is further from the truth, because everybody is a philosopher. Every single person on the street is a philosopher. If they weren't a philosopher, then they would just believe there's the medical, there's the psychological. They go to the doctor and say, medically, what should I do? And just tell them the psychological what I should do. That'd be the end of it. But people don't think that way. And they write nothing. Because medicine and psychology takes a person so far. And now you're psychologically healthy, okay? Now what do you do with your life? What kind of a life is the best life to live? Everybody's a philosopher. That's what all these periodicals sell. That's why National Enquirer sells. But people want to read about these weird things, these strange things. Why? They're inquiring. It's true. They're trying to figure out what is the best kind of the curious. Maybe this person has a kind of a life that acts where it's at. See if I should get into that kind of a lifestyle. So So all these magazines, all these journals, and all these papers, whether they're on the level of the New York Times or on the National Enquirer, doesn't make a difference. The point is, what it shows you about man is that people are searching for a lifestyle that is better, or that they feel is one that they would want to be, or want to be there. If they can't get themselves to want to read about something like that. So everybody's really a philosopher. Everybody's searching for a philosophy, a way of life that has to do with something that's not my psyche and not my physical body. So what is it? That's the soul of man. It pertains to something else. We call that the soul. So we call that part of man is the soul. The truth of the matter is that even the simplest individual on the street is a philosopher. Because whatever he does has to be based on something. Mainly, in his life mainly, has to be based on something that's not physical and not psychological. The first thing that does it every morning is say, I think I'll spend my day taking care of my physical and psychological health. You want to do that, because most people are fortunate. Unless a person, God forbid, has an illness where their whole life is preoccupied with that. That's an unfortunate situation. But the average person who doesn't have that, they feel that, well, okay, I'm healthy, and now fine, I'm okay, what am I going to do with my day? So the moment you say you're going to do something with your day, you have to make a decision. What am I going to do? Different possibilities. Whatever you do is a philosophical decision. You say I'm going to spend my day working, that's a philosophical decision. You mean you're better off, your soul will be better off if you spend your day working, if you stay home and watch television. It's a philosophical decision. See? Because if you thought you'd be better off watching television, you'd watch television. Or vice versa. Versus, I think I'll spend my day today, I'm going to spend my day playing football. Okay? Philosophical decision. Because you're saying that I will be better off spending my morning playing football than studying mathematics and learning or then engaging in making money or whatever other activity a person might envision. So everything a person does in their life, once you get away from the medical, and once you get away from the psychological, is really what? Philosophical. So I see how many philosophers there are out there. There's many people in there, there's so many philosophers there. That's what I know from that.
Yeah. I believe that there's such thing as a trend in response, but if we know all the factors that went into the person, all the psychological and physical factors, we can predict how they react. That's pattern behavior and
so in other words, you think that the person does not make any decision?
Not consciously.
Not consciousness with it? In other words, you're saying that whatever, you're saying really there's no purpose for you to decide. There's nothing that you could do, you're saying? You're saying there's nothing you can really do.
In a sense, I'm the product of all the influence that I've been exposed to.
In other words, you're like a robot.
Yeah.
In other words, you're really basically nothing more than a programmed computer, or a very sophisticated computer. And there's nothing really that you can do and or pursue.
To break the mold.
What?
To break the mold. So even if I were to do something that went against it, it was based on some input that would have led me in that direction.
So in other words, how do you make any decisions?
Well, I guess I have two ways of making a decision. Either consciously draw upon that what I've experienced and what I've been told, and or I can just react. That's
you have a choice. What do you have to do?
Well, I would still have some. It's not a question of I don't have the choice to choose. I do it. Instinctively, I react either one of those ways. There's never a question to me, should I? I don't ask myself if I should think about it or just do it. I will do one of those, but I don't ask myself if I should.
The other says that you should do A or B.
My reaction is, I'll do what I think is right, but I'm not going to ask myself if I think it's right.
You're not going to ask yourself if you can do it. Well, let's say, for instance, in terms of your future. Okay? So you're not going to ask yourself or think into whether or not you know, we should be better off in this profession or another profession? Or whether you should marry this girl or that girl, you're not going to fit into that?
Not as much. Yeah, but doesn't matter if I think about it, the what's going to come out at the end of my train of thought will still be the response that the core of the information has been put there. My decision of if I go to college or whatever I'll do will be based upon what all the information I've gathered and how it just naturally sort of filtered through my processes.
So when you get up in the morning, you just don't have to do anything. You have no decisions to make.
No original decision.
Yeah, I don't care about original or not, but do you make decisions?
Not fundamentally.
You don't make any decisions?
In terms of getting on the bus and going to school, I do, but...
What about in terms of pursuing your profession, in terms of whether you should study now, whether you should go play? All those kind of decisions. Are those decisions that you're making on the bus?
I make them, but that does not necessarily mean that there's a sort of component to my person that impacts that. Because those decisions are the outgrowth of all the experience.
So what advice would you give somebody? So you just don't make any decisions?
No, expose yourself to experience so that you have
to... Oh, expose yourself. But do they have a choice to expose themselves or not?
Not in the brain. They're a little case again, but if you look at the entire picture...
Oh, forget about it, but they're a little case. They can't really get
Well, I'm going to have to come up.
They can't. So you're telling them that is really a waste of time.
Then what's a waste of time?
In other words, you say to somebody, look... Let's say you have a child, right? You say, look, I want to tell you something. In this life, there are good ways to go. Let's assume that there are ways that reap more benefits and there are ways that reap less benefits. You agree with that, don't you? And when a person is just a drunkard and just keeps drinking, this is a bad way of life. Right? And then let's say, for instance, you would... a person who pursues a course, a normal course, like the course of a profession, or a course of an intelligent course. There are intelligent ways of living and there are non-intelligent ways. You agree with that, right? And, well, then in other words, you're telling me you can't tell somebody, like you can't tell a friend of yours or a student of yours, eventually you have children, a child of yours, look, you're going in the wrong course. You really should be pursuing an intelligent course. You can't tell a person.
You can tell them, but if you tell them, then just sort of incorporate into their subconscious, and eventually they won't be able to make a decision because they will react to the sum of the influence that they've been.
Well, you're saying that to say to a person, let's say you tell your child, you know, you are going in the wrong direction. You have to get a hold of yourself. Look, you're making a mistake. You should really go in this direction. So you really should be making the wrong decision. You're saying that whole statement is a lie.
It's not a lie.
So then what are you saying?
It can be sincere advice, but I'm just saying that the child will not make it. The child will just react based upon its evaluation, which is not necessarily a conscious evaluation.
Yeah, but I'm just saying, but the child, if the child is the child says, you know, you're right, I really have to summon all my energies and do this, and no matter how much I feel pulled in the other direction, I have to really make active. Is that a decision? Is that a process?
Why does the child do that?
That's because you're...
Why does the child do that?
Because your statement is affected the general context, not where it's changed to affect what he's going to do.
Yeah, but you're saying that your statement is really a lie then.
Why?
Because you're telling the person, look, you're making a wrong decision. Think into this, and you'll make the right decision. Yeah. But the person really has no ability to do that.
No. The person, you're sort of just trying to add weight to one side of the scale.
Oh, but what you're saying is not true. Because you're implying that the person can make a decision.
In terms of the wording, it's not.
Well, not just the wording, it's an idea. You convey to the person an idea that they have to make this decision. That's what you're saying to them. That's really what's impressing them. And that thing is really not true. Right? So in other words, you're saying, and they can't, and if they thought that way, and they have to think that what you're saying is true, otherwise it's not going to impact, right? Alright? Because if they don't think
that
way, so
if they believe it or not, it will still filter into their subconscious and eventually.
In other words, the reason why you're impacting on them is because of the nature of the statement where you're telling them that you have the ability to go to either do A or B, and you're making a big mistake. Now summon up all your energies and do A, because B is going to lead you into disaster.
False statements impact people.
But I'm not saying that's true or false. I'm saying, but they're going to have to believe that that's so. Because if they didn't believe that was so, if they believe what you believe, that there's really no such ability, then they wouldn't be impacted, they wouldn't be affected. Isn't that right?
Looking at it as a chain, it seems that originally there must have been some input, but it's passed along. There must have been some decisions at some point, but it just seems that we can't really make a decision after its nature and nurture. We can't.
My question still is this: that if I go to you and I say, "Look," I say, "you are making a very foolish decision. You agree, for instance, that a person should pursue knowledge?" And you say, "Yes." I say, "Well, I'm telling you now, you're not doing that. So you, and I know how strong your emotions are against that, but you really have to take hold of yourself, and you have to really pursue knowledge." And you say, "You're right. I'm being misled over here. I have to really follow the source." Now, this whole discussion that we're having is assuming that you have the ability to do and to follow and to make changes, and that you're not an automaton. Because if you assume you're an automaton, this whole conversation wouldn't have an impact on you. Because the impact comes from the fact that you can do it. Do you understand what I'm saying?
The software knows what to do, but it still needs an input that it triggers that reaction.
I understand, but if I would tell you, you're a computer, okay, I'm not going to be able to affect you that way, right? And so the only way I'm affecting you is by telling you that you have the free will to make a decision. And the only way that you can live is thinking in terms of decision making, and that you're making decisions, right?
Computer program code. Programmed to react certain way to certain situations.
That's correct. That's a computer. That's right.
Now, if you say something with enough impact, maybe it'll have the impact to change the base code of the computer.
I understand all that. But I'm just saying that in your mind, if you accepted that model of yourself, you simply could not function. So the only way you're functioning is by accepting a different model. You follow? Right?
That's a separate question.
But the point is, you are destined to follow, to live a life which is based in your mind on the fact that you are not a computer. Because if your mind, if you look at yourself as a computer, you couldn't do any decision. You never have decision making. You never have advice. You never receive advice. Your whole program will be completely destroyed. So you must live a life which is based on the fact that you're exactly the opposite of what you're saying. Your whole life would be impossible if you really thought of yourself as just programmed. Because then the whole world of decision making, the whole experience decision making, the whole idea of advice, the whole idea of giving advice, all of these things would become irrelevant, and once they became irrelevant, you wouldn't be able to function.
It's called the other function.
What?
So you're saying that you could not make a decision?
Mm-hmm.
A computer can't make a decision.
A computer make it. I wouldn't call it a decision like we make a decision, but if you're saying, it depends what you mean by decision. If by decision you mean something that goes on in our mind, that we call decision, okay, can a computer do that? The answer is no. If you want to say, well, decision means making a choice between A and B, a computer can be programmed to do that. But that's a different meaning of the word decision. Now you're just looking at the effect of decision. But the effect of decision is, did it go A or did it go B? It came to an impasse, and then certain variables have to be, there's an activity of variables, and it goes A or B. Now, that's what you mean by decision, but that is not really a replica of the process that goes on in the human mind. That's just an accident, just a feature of it. In other words, it's like saying a lot of things look alike, but are not alike. but they have certain common characteristics, okay? But just because they have common characteristics or even common outcomes, it doesn't mean that the source is the same, okay? So insofar as man is concerned, you see, if a person would view themselves as a computer, the whole function of decision making and advice and giving advice and receiving advice and function would become impossible. So therefore that idea is one which has no practical relevance to any human being what? On the contrary, it's very impractical, you see. So you have to live with the idea that you have free will, whether you like it or not.
What if artificial intelligence were to know?
So?
When, if it were possible to create a computer that had these our functions, so that would represent our thought function.
What? So
that would have certain philosophical implications.
No, it wouldn't. There's no philosophical implication. I think people are misled into thinking that it would, because people are very excited about seeing something. It's like people that they see a bird feeding babies, and you see that the mother so caringly takes the worm and brings it to the nest. And the babies open their mouths, and the mother feeds them. And when a person sees this, they say, "Wow, look at it! That's such just like a mother, a human mother, feeds and takes care of their child with such devotion and such caring. You know what I mean? That this is an unbelievable phenomenon in nature. A little bird like that should do something like that." And then if you get more educated, you find out that the mother is not, in fact, doing that. All the mother is doing is the mother is reacting to a yellow spot inside the baby's mouth. When the baby opens his mouth, there's a yellow spot on his clothes, and she is instinctually programmed to just put the worm at that spot. And really, this whole image that you projected onto the bird is non-existent. The bird is not operating like a human being. So we have the tendency to project onto animals, for instance, our own emotions and our own feelings, which don't exist. Like a person has a dog, they feel the dog loves them, just like they love the dog. But they don't realize that a dog is not constructed the way we are psychologically. So what looks like love to you is not the same as what you feel towards the dog, because you are not a dog. Dog is a totally programmed in a different way. It's completely different. So we tend to project onto the external world a lot of our own feelings. That's why you see people do investigations into animal intelligence, because there is a very big question as to why there is such a gap between human intelligence and animal intelligence. The gap is immense, and people try to study animals to see if it's the same type of intelligence that we have, you see. And you'll find, in my opinion, that most of the things that they come up with are really based on a certain emotional attitude of the investigator that usually identifies very strongly with animals and is trying to project onto the animal life the same type of things that we have. But that is not necessarily true, just like in the case of a bird. And the same thing is true with computers. When a person sees something that looks similar to them, there's a tendency to project onto that thing the same identity. It looks similar, hey, that's just like me. And the same thing is true with computers. That people see computers, if you see a robot working, it hits your imagination, hey, that's just like me. It's walking, it's doing, it's making decisions. And therefore, since it appears to be like me, so you project on the thing that it is the same thing as me. But there is no comparison whatsoever, just because there are external similarities. This is what the philosophers of old had a term for that. They called it accidents and essences. So in essence is, you say, And you say that one mother feels towards a child the same as another mother feels towards a child, then you're comparing essences. If you say the way a mother feeds a baby is the same as a bird feeds its chicks, then you're comparing accidents. Okay, you're taking accidental features. And the same thing is true with the computer, that most people are not really intelligent enough to really go into that, to really analyze the problem in a logical way. But they're impressed with the externals. And the externals give a certain appearance. And this appearance influences them very much, unless a person is really trained mentally to distinguish between appearances and reality, which is a tremendous subject that takes years and years of work in order to be able to distinguish between those two areas. Because a person, the younger a person is, the more imaginative they are, and the more impressed they are by the imaginative part of the mind. And as a person becomes more scientific and learned and knowledgeable, so then the person starts following a different part inside themselves, which is the part of knowledge, not the part of imagination. So that the person does develop intellectually, they become more impressed with the intellectual and with the imaginary. I'll give you a simple example. The famous story about the person who did great favor to the king. And the king said to the person, he said, well, what can I do for you? So he said, all you have to do is put a chessboard down. And says, all you have to do is put one grain of wheat in this first box, and then just keep doubling it around the chessboard. And the king said, no problem, I'll do it. It's yours. Turns out that the amount of grain that would be necessary in the last box would be more than the world produced until about the 17th century or something, some such thing, right? So why is that so? Because a person is very impressed with, that's the imaginative faculty. Imagination can't fathom how that's possible, that at the end you're going to have billions and billions and trillions of barrels of grain, right? But the mathematical mind, the trained mathematician, is beyond the world of the imagination, and he's into the world of logic and mathematics, and he's not, if he is in truth a mathematician, he's impressed by the mathematics and the logic, not the imaginative. So the more a person advances in every field, they will find that knowledge is always counterintuitive. In other words, knowledge is always against what your initial intuition is. The person thinks, if you ask a person, for instance, about Muktzah, think about Muktzah. So I think it's possible. Well, could I do this? Like, would I be able to do this on Shabbos? Would I be able to move the phone off the table? Nah, it's Muktzah. See? And when a person learns Muktzah, they have a whole different view of it. Just like a mathematician has a whole different view of mathematical phenomena, and a physicist has a whole different view of physical phenomena. But this idea that you are mentioning, which is that a computer could be human-like, is based on pure imagination. Because a computer is not of the same source as we are. The essence of a computer could never be the essence of man. It's a completely different thing. And as sophisticated as the programming will get, it will still never get out of the realm of what it is, which is a programmed thing. And we are completely different. Our essence, our structure, which we don't even understand biologically, but we do know that there is a structure there. That structure is completely of a different form than the computer. So you could never, it's only on the surface in your imagination when you see a robot, you say, well, that looks like a person. Maybe that is a person. But it can't be. It's virtually impossible because it's of a different source. It's a different creation.
But we wouldn't know that unless we were to create something with our exact composition and our... I'm saying, if we were to create something with our exact chemical
reference... You mean, can we do that?
Organic computing, whatever it may be.
Can we create something which is the same organic essence as we are? That's your question, right?
No, if our organic essence were replicated and all...
Yeah, but then it would be replicated, it would be an organic essence. Wouldn't be a computer.
Isaac Asimov.
Yes, sir. In other words, if you replicated it, then you're right. Then the only question is, can man do that, or only God can do that? It's a separate question. But you understand that? But that would be a computer. That would be something other than a computer.
Yeah, of course,
computer
can't not wrong.
But then there is no question anymore. But then your question is gone, because your question, the original question was, can a computer be like us? And the answer is absolutely not, because it's a completely different thing. But the next question is, can we replicate an organic entity the same as we are? But then it'll be the same. So then there's no question anymore. In other words, either it's not or it's the same. But to say that a computer is us, that is pure imagination. Because a computer is not an organic, not the same, not the same substance as we are. Obviously, it can't be the same.
We could drop either term, though. We could start calling us computers, or we could start calling them
humans. You can use any term you want. Terms are, use terms freely. But a term doesn't make the thing. Just because you use a term does not make the thing reality.
But of course, the computer is not what we are. Could it come to a level?
Come to what level? Could it be exactly as we are now?
Could it make decisions?
That's what I said. It depends what you mean by the word decision. Can it do what we call
not
decision?
No,
absolutely not. It cannot have that. Because our what we call decision is a certain experience which is based on our organic substance and whatever else we are constructed of. That it can never have, because that's what we mean by decision. If by decision you mean what goes on in your mind, that is a very unique kind of a thing. No computer can do that, because it's not the same. It's not possible. That's like saying the bird is like the person. Because the bird does the same thing.
What about computer explicit theories? They started selling something called NewGens, which is neural network technology, which supposedly thinks.
Well, it depends what you mean by thinks. If by thinks you mean what goes on in the human mind, it cannot. That's not possible. Because what goes on in the human mind is based on the fact that we have a certain chemistry. And if that doesn't have that chemistry, it's not going to be the same thing. Does it replicate a certain feature? That's possible to replicate features that, for instance, a human being is able to calculate. This is an old one. You can have a calculator that does the same thing. But there's no difference between that. The more sophisticated you get, you see, a change in quantity does not mean a change in quality. So, therefore, as long as you're still in the same ballpark, you're not getting out of that ballpark. You know, you could do more work and complicate things in that ballpark, but you are not changing the ballpark. So I don't care how complicated or sophisticated you get. You have the most sophisticated machine, it's still a machine. Okay, the sophistication is not going to remove it from being a machine. It's not going to make it into a biological, organic entity. But that's a very good question. That's an extremely important question. Very good question. But that has to do with, and I said, that's really why Torah really is extremely important. Because Torah teaches a person how to differentiate and how to think and differentiate between what is real, what the mind is telling you, or what your imagination is telling you. And as a person grows and learning and knowledge, the person realizes that they should not be influenced by the imaginative part of man, but rather by the intellectual part of man, by the part of man which is based on our thought. To distinguish between those two, because it's extremely important, because you can be fooled very easily in that area. But you have a question?
Yeah. I asked him about throwing out plans for an android.
For what?
An android.
Yes.
That actually mimic every activity of the human brain, I think, except for emotion. We didn't have the materials to build it.
Well, that's the same thing. I understand this idea. That you can mimic activities. There's no question about it. But the mimicking of activities doesn't make the thing the same. A thing is still something different than an activity. You follow? That's not right. Now the question, of course, is, can man, you brought an interesting question, can a human being ever produce, really, another human being? That's a good question. But that's what it would have to be if you want to have the same thing. It would not be the same level. You just have activities. But the question is, can a human being do that? It's an interesting thing. But the Chazal there is a chazal that seems to indicate that a person would be able to do such a thing.
I can see us building a dead body to bring it into life again.
Well, that's a matter of, see, that's a quantitative question. In other words, could we advance in knowledge to the point where we could actually do such a thing? There is a Gemara in Sanhedrin, and it's a cryptic Gemara. And I guess people would call it Kabbalistic, in the sense that I hate to use that word because it's very misused and misunderstood. But it means to say the real meaning of Kabbalah is a source of knowledge that we were able to receive via nevuah, via prophecy, from our prophets, that is something that you could not know just simply from ordinary intelligence, based upon the advance of science. Okay? And the Gemara does say, the Gemara in Sanhedrin seems to say, in a parable, they always make a story out of it because they don't want people to really understand, people who aren't ready to understand these things to know exactly what it is, and they want an intelligent person to be able to figure it out and see it. And that Gemara would seem to indicate that it is possible. So it is possible for man at some time in the future to be able to be able to replicate a human being. But I'm just telling you, there is a Gemara that indicates that, that it'll be able to create animals and androids or things like that. But that's something which the only way the Gemara could have known that at that time would be from Kabbalah. This is from Kabbalah, so it would not be possible for a person. Science was not advanced enough at that time to be able to draw such conclusions. But there is a Gemara that indicates that. Whether that's the right thing to do for man, or whether we will ever do it, is another. That's another question. That's where man needs a lot of guidance. And that's something which perhaps brings me to an important topic, I think, in terms of today's life, the world we live in. And the world we live in, everybody's very excited about it, and where all the luxuries will become so readily available that man will have everything he needs. I'm not talking about everybody being worth $13 billion. I'm talking about everybody having what $13 billion can do for you in terms of significance, which is you don't need that much money. In terms of all the luxuries that you would need for the human organism to be satisfied in that realm, okay, not an endless fantasy, but in other words, you take every creature has a certain need, and man is no different in that respect. And you can take a chimpanzee and bring him into a 5-star hotel, you're not really doing any good because it's beyond his need. That's not what he needs. And the same thing is true of man. Man has a certain need for luxury and a certain need for convenience, but it's a fixed thing, like anything else. And when you get beyond that point, then you distort him and you take him away, just like you take the monkey and put him in a place where you're giving him all kinds of luxuries, but that's not what he needs. He just needs to move on the trees and his body is in a certain way, and if you don't do that, maybe make him happy for a few hours, but you're really in the wrong way to get along. Same thing is true of man. Man has a certain description, and today people are recognizing that even though, you know, people on the farm years ago, in the Second World War, people that came from the farms into the army were really much, much more fit than people that came from the city. Because people in the farm, they worked, and they were physically much, much, much better. But later, after that, and later in Vietnam, there's no difference because everything's automated. So automation is good, but then it's bad because, you know, you're really constructed in a certain way. If you don't follow that description, then you're physically going to be losing out. But the same thing is true psychologically, and the same thing is true philosophically. So the Ramban describes a time, he says, that is our idea, Mimosa Mashiach. Mimosa Mashiach means that man will reach a time where all his needs for convenience and even for luxury will be easily met. Okay? That's going to be an unbelievable time. You see, everybody will have it. Readily available. What?
Might be boring.
Exactly. You see, but God created the world in a way, just like the world really imitates human life also. Because you see, in human life, from the time you're a child, you go through different stages, and the person has to keep on developing and readjusting. Otherwise, you know, until the final stages, before the person dies, before they face death, that's the ultimate stage of human existence. A person really, as an Amapati, a person's whole life is really geared towards that moment. Now, people don't want to think about that, because that's something that goes against their emotions. But the truth of the matter is that everything in life has a reason. If a person progresses properly, the moment of death is not a sad moment. On the contrary, it's something that she is ready to accept, and to not only accept it's something it has to accept, but you can understand it. That's a part of life, a significant part of life. The Rama says that people are on a very high level, they reach their highest moment at that time before they depart. So so everything is really a state. And the truth of the matter is, the same is true of the world. That since the purpose of man, and you fellows have the opportunity to know that, the purpose of human existence is not the physical pleasures, not the luxuries, although we need these things, this is not really the main purpose. But the end purpose of man is really, you can see, that part of man which is the greatest part of him, and that is his intelligence and his mind. And that differentiates him from the other animals, both physically, in terms of his way he's structured, his cranium and his brain and his intelligence, and everything that you see around you, which is a result essentially of man's intelligence. That part of man is really his essence, and the ultimate situation is where all of these are taken care of, and he'll engage in that part of his essence. And that's really the area where we'll gain the greatest enjoyment out of ideas, the greatest enjoyment out of thinking. We'll be bothered with the other things. So that a person who is developed properly as a human being will have a wonderful existence. They won't be bothered with the other things. A person who is not developed properly, of course, at that time, will be horrified. That's why the Gemara says in the Moshe Mashiach, the ultimate, the time of the Moshe Mashiach will be a wonderful period for the righteous and a terrible period for the wicked. Doesn't mean that, as people imagine, that God is just going to punish the wicked, you know, that God has a lollipop and a stick, and there's going to be of the dead people. You know, that's a childish idea. I mean, people believe that way, and maybe on a certain level, some people can't think any other way. But it's excusable, but it's obviously not true. But the true idea is that as the world progresses, and that's something that God built into the creation. As a matter of fact, the Kishua, where God, in Bereshit, says God told him the Kishua, he should conquer the earth. And that means that God gave man, he constructed the universe in a way that man, and the earth in a way, that man can do unbelievable conquest with a very limited knowledge. As a matter of fact, Bertrand Russell says that the amazing thing, it wasn't his thing, he's quoting somebody else, that says that the amazing thing about science is how much you can do with how little you know. Because you don't really understand electricity, and without understanding it, you can do amazing things. So the world, that's the Kishua, means that built in, programmed into this world is the fact that man can take care of his needs eventually as he progresses in a very easy way, even with a little bit that he knows. But the eventual world of our existence will be a world where people will be enjoying ideas and thoughts and discussions, and like we're having now, discussions and thinking, and this is really what man was made for. This is the essence of his, even physically it's reflected, even biologically it's reflected. This is the essence of his existence, and that really is the ideal idea of the Moshe Mashiach. At the end of the Rambam, and that's something that we could not have known, of course, from science, because at that time science didn't progress. That was that's a Gemara. But we knew that from Kabbalah. That means that from the Nevi'im, this idea was transferred. And that's the advantage of Nevuah. The advantage of Nevuah is that there are certain facts that are very important. And you can't know them if you're going to wait for the world to progress and to find out. Generations are going to be lost. So God had to give us just the final statement, you see, and at least you know which direction to go. And you have the prescription. You may not understand the medication that works, but you have the prescription from the physician that this is what you're supposed to do. So at least you're not going to lose your life until you find out what the right thing is to do. So that idea is, I mean, that's really the concept of the of the ultimate situation, which you can see we're rapidly, I mean, this last 10 years, it's been rapid progression from such a state. But there is a very serious problem with that state, and that is a problem that you can see yourself. You know, they made a toll of the people who won the lotteries. You know, people won millions of dollars, and these people were poor people, most of them, and they always felt that if only they had more money, their problems would be solved. They follow them up like 10 years later, and they see they're more in debt than they were before. They've lost their friends and their relatives, and most of them, the large majority of them were more unfortunate afterwards than they were before. And the reason is very simple. The reason is because, in this case, to take a simple example, money gives a person options. But a person has to be ready, prepared to exercise options. If you're not prepared to exercise options, you're better off without these options. Okay? And success, what the world calls success, which is an illusion, basically, I don't think it's such a word, such a term, it's something which gives a person a lot of opportunities. And if you're not ready to exercise the opportunities, you see, that's why the Torah, the curse of man, is also a blessing. Because many personalities, if they were not successful, would still be alive today. Take a person like Elvis Presley, who was extremely successful. But if he were a truck driver, he'd probably be alive today. Whereas now he's gone because a lot of options were available to him, and he didn't have the intelligence and the ability to handle them properly. So he made decisions that resulted in his own destruction. So, I mean, just one example. I mean, there are many examples like that. Not that he was a bad person; he was just a person that, you know, just was not, unfortunately, didn't have the knowledge and the ability to make the right decision. But the same thing is true with the world at large. The question of if we could make a human being, would it be the right thing to do? Would that be a problem? These are questions. In other words, science has given us tremendous options. Tremendous options. The question is, are we ready to deal with the options, or are we like a person an ignorant person who suddenly is fortunate to be, you know, find themselves in a situation where they have the means available to do a lot of different things, but they don't have the intelligence to know what to do. They'd be better off if they never... So if I take my child and giving them the option to cross the street. It's a new option, but what's going to happen to the child? They're hit by the car. You see? So options are not always good. And that's the really importance. I mean, the conversation happened to roll along in this direction, but I think it's a good direction. And because I think it comes back to you guys. Right? You guys are in yeshiva, and you have the opportunity to learn Torah. And this is the only science which deals with this question. How to exercise the options. There's a tremendous world out there of technology and science which is working and rapidly succeeding and advancing and exploding the various possibilities, and the various options are increasing by astronomical rates, I mean, every day. But the question is, what about the science of gaining the knowledge to know how to exercise these options properly? That science is not advancing one iota. As a matter of fact, if you study, if you take a look at some of the studies that are made, you see that, for instance, 83%, I may be off by 3 points, 83% of people go into stores and buy these little figurines. And they believe these little angels, they put them in their homes, and they believe these little angels are helping them. And you see clearly how in the same society, how man is such a, and this is something that Yehudah Sword gives us, that man is a crazy creature. He can be intelligent over here and be an utter fool over there. In one place he's intelligent, another place he's an idiot. So this is a very dangerous thing, because, I mean, sometimes a physician has to make a decision. A physician and doctors have told me that a lot of times they don't know what to do, because you have a patient, and the patient has certain crazy ideas about medicine. And the doctor says, if I tell this person what I'm doing, they're not going to do it. Because they have some other idea, some crazy idea that this is harmful, and that they're better off with an alternative medicine cure, which the doctor says, I know is going to kill them. And what do I do with them? Do I tell them the truth, or do I fool them and have them take the medication? It's a serious question. Not easy against it. I can't say I know the answer myself all the time. But you have to, you know, you have to think, but at least if you have Torah and you have knowledge, you're in that area. When you study, this is the most vital area. One day the world is going to recognize this. And I'm putting this, and I'm putting all catches up. But one day it wasn't a red nose. They had all the options they have, but they don't know, they have no, they have, they have, they don't have any program that can tell them how to deal with the options. And that's really the significance of what you are doing now in the Shiva, learning Torah. It's Torah is that science. And there's no other subject that teaches that. No, I can guarantee you. There's no university, there's no subject, there's nowhere in the world you can learn that besides the Shiva. Yes?
Side of catching up with individual instances of, let's say, like genetic engineering right now, like, that might catch up with us in the native layer at some point. But why would the general condition right be needed?
I'll tell you what, that's what you said before. You gave the answer before. You said that when I spoke about the advances in technology, you said, and I said everybody's going to have all the luxuries, you said it's going to be a very boring existence. And it will be, because most of you take a look at Bill Gates. Why does Bill Gates get up every morning and have to go through these horrible, painful experiences fighting the government, and I guarantee his stomach is churning, and he's angered, and he's upset. Would you have laughed? You had 13 billions, I don't know what the number is, but billions and billions of dollars, I mean, people think that's insane, right? But the answer is because he is afflicted with a certain unfortunate disease that he can't escape from, because he can't really enjoy himself. If he could, he wouldn't be doing this. But he can't, so he's caught. So what is his enjoyment? It's a competitive, the enjoyment of competition, a competitive. I have more money than you have. I'm more successful than you. It's a game. And that's why when they disclose some of his tactics, they show the viciousness and the enjoyment he had in putting people out of business and destroying people financially, how he gloated and just loved it, you know, that this is what drives the man. The most base, you know, but he's intelligent, very intelligent in one area. But in the area of life, he has no knowledge of any area of philosophy, no knowledge of intelligence or anything. So, and if he did have knowledge, he would be having a much better life. I guarantee you. I guarantee you that Albert Einstein had a far, far more enjoyable existence. I would take one day in Albert Einstein's life over his Bill Gates' entire life. Okay, and I'd say, I'd be assured, Einstein, I'd have a better existence. Okay? So perfection is really the goal, is really the goal that man should see. And like you said, like you yourself said, all these advances, it's going to be very boring if you, because then one day this all the competitive is going to be, you know, lose steam, because people are going to say it's all crazy. What's the difference? You know, whatever, Mayanese and world didn't hear it. And people are going to wake up and they say, then what's the purpose of our existence? That could be the most horrible thing. You'll notice yourself that many people who become successful, strangely enough, destroy themselves. In one way or another, sometimes, whether it's direct method of suicide, or whether it's a method that's indirect. And, you know, there's a lot of ways to destroy yourself. You know, you destroy yourself slowly, you destroy yourself in 1 second, you know? And you'll notice a lot of people, and you read the media, you'll see that a lot of people, when you look at it in a stance, like in one week, so they became successful and they destroyed themselves. Why did they do this? It's like, what was it, Mickey Mantle said, before he died? He said, I was a total fool. I had everything, God gave me everything that anyone could ask for. I had totally destroyed myself. So you see, you recognize, people recognize that. They recognize that. Now, there will be, slowly, people are, in my opinion, and this is, you know, everybody, you know, talks about the Gula Hasidah, you know, the Moshe Mashiach. But in my opinion, I'll give you my opinion about it, you don't have to accept it, but it's just something that I'll share with you, and that is that the real idea of the Moshe Mashiach is that people will eventually see, like you said, that if we don't find something more significant, it's going to be a very boring experience, and we're going to start destroying ourselves. You know, there's one time, I don't know if you saw the original, the original King Khan, but sometimes they bring it back. So they had a very interesting thing over there. They showed the Khan, you know, the big gorilla, you know, and these natives, you know, their whole life is trying to get away from Khan, you know, I don't know exactly, but they had some kind of a ceremony once a year, you know, and, so then they said, we're going to take Khan, we're going to capture Khan and bring him to, civilization. So one guy said over there, he says, if you do this, he says, we'll save these people, they won't have to worry about Khan anymore. So he says, You do that, and you come back a year from now, you'll find a bunch of drunkards on this island. Kind is what they need, you see? Which is very true. That is a true philosophical. That as long as they have these fears and have something to live for, but otherwise they're living in a paradise. They have everything they need. What are they going to do? They're just going to start drinking. And there's nothing more to do. And this is a boring existence. Same idea. So the whole the concept of the Moshe Mashiach, the real, in my opinion, two kinds of Moshe Mashiach is that man will eventually wake up. Once he realizes he's gotten beyond everything he needs, now what do I do? There's got to be something for man to do that has intrinsic value and worth, besides trying to destroy the other guy or try to show that you're the wealthiest guy or even the smartest guy or whatever it might be. There's got to be something more real than that. And that really, that's what the Torah is teaching us. That there is something more real. There is something far better than that. And that is to spend your life in Chachmas HaTorah, in the wisdom of the Torah, which is really an all-inclusive concept, but it has a certain direction to it, and with knowledge of God, the Dias Hashem, knowledge of God, which the Chachmas HaTorah leads to. And that's a kind of a life which is really the ultimate existence. The Torah, and that's what you guys are really learning and accomplishing when you learn Torah. I know it's a long road, and it looks like it's very distant. But it's worthwhile to be on the right road, even if it's the wrong one. And be in the wrong one, even if it's a short one. So actually, I'm very glad that the discussion actually naturally evolved around to this area, which is very pertinent. Yes?
Just seems like we should study the wisdom of the Torah, but why? What's its purpose?
Okay, what's the purpose? That's the question. So now that's an excellent question. And you know what my answer is? My answer is, there's no purpose. See, the idea of a purpose means I'm doing X to get Y. Which means to say, get money and go to work. What's the purpose? To get money. But then let's keep going. So what's the purpose of money? Oh, if I can buy things. What's the purpose of buying things?
Power.
What?
Power.
To have power. Okay, what's the purpose of power?
To feel good about yourself.
And what's the purpose of feeling good about yourself?
Being happy.
And what's the purpose of being happy?
What's considered happiness, the ultimate good.
Oh, so when you get to the ultimate good, there's no purpose, right?
Yeah.
That's what's wrong, there's no purpose. Right? There's no, that which has no purpose is far greater than that which has a purpose. Because that which has a purpose is going towards something else. But then when you finally get to the end, there can't be any purpose. This can't go on forever. So everything was done for that. So that is the ultimate thing. So the ultimate thing is to have an existence where there's no purpose. It's a funny thing. I told somebody the other day, I said, what did you do today? I said, I did something that has absolutely no purpose. I said, I didn't do anything. I didn't make any money. I didn't do anything even for anybody. I just was doing something that had absolutely no purpose. And the guy says, what are you doing? What did you do? I said, I was learning. Learning. I was studying a Gemara that has to do with Erevin. That has to do with 2 yards on Shabbos and carrying from one to the other. Something which a person, who cares about that? What's the difference? But it was so intriguing, so interesting. It gave me an insight into a certain halacha, which I enjoyed so much, and I didn't do it for any purpose. I just did it because it was a beautiful and it was a great experience. I gain knowledge of God. I know, no purpose whatsoever. But that's the highest. That's what one. What is it? You say every morning. We say when you say the brachos for learning Torah. It's learning yodei shemecha. You should have knowledge of God. Yes, because that's the ultimate. Alone day sorasecha lishma. Learning the Torah. What does the shma mean? What does that mean? No purpose. When you do something that's unsaid, it means there's no purpose in it. But that's what we want. The highest level is to be able to do something for no purpose. Now don't go out of here and say, Rabbi Chait said that we should do things that have no purpose. Because I don't think people will understand exactly the context of the conversation. I think the others are not going to.
It seems like a little...
So you know why? I'll tell you why it seems like a little... Because we're conditioned. And
we're conditioned, and that's what's a very hard thing to learn for its own sake, was we're conditioned from early youth. You've got to do something for this purpose, for that purpose, for the next purpose. What do you mean? What's the reason? What's the purpose in doing this? So we are so conditioned that we forget that the ultimate thing is to do things for no purpose. That's really what all these purposes are, to get to a certain state. Oh, what's that state? That state has no purpose. But people are so, and that's why I'll tell you an interesting thing. I've noticed people, and that's what you'll see. People that are even, let's take the material world. I use the material world as easy as a muscle, you know? And that's why I think Michelin uses a lot too. But you take a person that suddenly becomes very affluent, okay? So you'll notice, what do they do? First, they'll take trips around the world, they'll buy houses, cars, and this stuff. Then you find this guy is back in the office every day. So why is he an affluent? That's when he only went to the office to make the money so he wouldn't have to be there. But the answer is, because very few people can enjoy something without it. They're so conditioned that they have to have a purpose. If they don't have a purpose, they can't enjoy it. So they make up a purpose. I met a fellow that, and you learn from everybody in life. When I say, you call along by yourself. The person that's really a chacham learns from everybody. It doesn't have to be necessarily an intelligent teacher. Be a plain person. Someone else says, I used to learn from a kid in the street. You know? And there's an individual who was totally unintellectual, but a man that had a business, and his business was making toys. And what happened was, it was a family business for 50 years, and he started the business about 27, 28, and by the time he was 50, something changed. What changed was that the foreign market started to compete. And he told me, he says, you know, Rabbi, I said, I couldn't compete with these guys. He says, they get paid maybe $10 a month. He says, I'm my workers. I was, it's costing me regular salaries. I couldn't compete with these guys. He says, that they could do this at work for a fraction of what I'm doing. So he said, my father, his father's an older person, so I said, Pop, I said, look, this doesn't make any sense. We're going to go broke. I mean, we've got to stop. I mean, we're just wasting money. So he said, as my father said to me, what should I do? So I said, look, now, you're an expert at making toys, but I know what's going on in the world. Right now, real estate is at a high. This was in the 80s. Right now, real estate is at a high. It says, Pop, we could sell out, but we have real estate, because the business is a family business for 50 years, and fortunately, we're sitting on some really great real estate, and we'll have millions of dollars, and we'll just divide up the money in among the family, and that's it. Goodbye. That's the smart thing to do. So his father said, I guess you're right. This is not one, you know? So he says, so he didn't tell me how much he got, but it sounds to me like I got like $3-4 million, you know? So he says, Rabbi, I told my wife, you know, we can't follow the lifestyle that we had in the past. We used to go spend money on vacations, tens of thousands of dollars, and it was reckless. Can't do it anymore. But if we want to live intelligently, we have enough money for the rest of our lives. I'm going to live nicely. A nice house in Woodmere, he drives a Mercedes, you know, and he has an excellent vacation, but he says, we have to keep an eye on what we're doing. Things go, you know, crazy. So it's not endless money. So he says to me, he says, Rabbi, you know what my big problem was? What am I going to do with it? What am I going to do? I have nothing to do. And he says, I decided I have to make up artificial goals in order to stay alive. And he's a fairly telling guy. So he says, I took a look at myself in the mirror, I see I'm about 80 pounds overweight. He says, I have a goal. So I'm going to start walking every day. He says, I'm going to be good for my health, and I'm giving something to do. He says, and there's a boardwalk at the beach. He says, Rabbi, when I first started, I couldn't get to the end of the boardwalk. He says, and now he's about 50 years old, he's going to go. And after, when I met him, he was doing 11 miles a day. 11 miles a day. From 12 o'clock to 3:30, somewhere around there, he would walk up and back, up and back. Yeah, you know, we'll listen to some radio, whatever. Up and back. And he says, now, he says, you see, I have to kill time. He says, I get up in the morning. I said, well, how do I spend my morning? He says, first thing I do is I go down and get a coffee and a muffin. He says, till I get up, till I go, I meet somebody, I talk, I take a look at the clock, it's 10:30, he says, another hour and a half, and 12 o'clock I'm on the bar. Yeah? He says, he kills a little time there, 12 hours on 3:30, he's finished. Goes home, he says, takes a shower, by the time watches a show, you know, I'm ready for supper, 6 o'clock, 6:30. Then he says, nah, at night time to figure out some way, you know, watch my television, this and that, talk to my wife a little bit of this, some of the calls, and I get through the day. So I thought to myself, I said, this guy, you see, man can't live without some, if he didn't have his walking, his walking goal, he'd have nothing. So a person who is unfortunate and doesn't have anything that they can really put their mind into, so what are they going to do? So you have to manufacture something. Well, most people are so oriented, goal-oriented, that they can't live without goals. Even though they don't need any goals, but they'll make up a goal. Is it possible? Is there, you guys say Yom? You know, if they're ladies, they're young. It says, Yotzer Omo Alecho. It says, the people that they create work in order to have a goal. Yotzer Omo Alecho. They don't have to work. They make the work, because you must have a goal, but you can't live without a goal. The Torah is a better way to live. That's a poor way to live. Better way to live, where you really have something that you're interested in, that you're enthusiastic about, that you're excited about. And that's knowledge and chachma and learning. And I'm learning something, I said, as if I told somebody, if I met a senator and I told them, learn about two houses next to each other, and Shabbos, carrying from one to the other, one has to be done, and the concepts that are involved in Eruv Chatzeros, you think, this is crazy, what are you doing? You see? To me, it's a whole world. It reminds me, the only similar thing I can tell you is, science in its early state was really the groundwork was created by people like that. Like when people studied trigonometry years ago, people looked at them like fools. Well, what are you doing here, you know? You're figuring out, is it, I'm standing on one side of the Grand Canyon and I'm looking at the other side of the Grand Canyon. I think, how could I measure that distance between us? I'm not going to go there, right? And then with enough mathematics you find out that walking on the same side, by walking a few feet, maybe if you know, on the same side, you could actually calculate the distance straight across. So it's unbelievable. The guy who thought that was excited, he said, that's amazing. I'm standing here on this, I can never get to this, and I can figure out the exact distance. So some another person said, what difference is that? Who cares about it? You see? But the person that's interested in ideas and excited about the ideas, can you imagine that? It's an unbelievable thing. And all science was being built on people who devoted their lives to things that were silly and what the world would call nonsensical and purposeless. But those were the people that built the mathematics and the basis of all the knowledge that we have. People that were devoted to areas that at that time people said, what are you doing? There's no practical purpose. But it turned out there is a practical purpose. But the truth of the matter is that they were greater than the people who are using it for practical purposes. Because they really were interested in the beauty of the knowledge itself. And where do you get that idea from? That's the main idea of the whole thing. What's the biggest mitzvah in Torah? Learning Torah with small. That's the central theme. That's the heart of the whole Torah. That's the biggest mitzvah. You can tell a system, as you see, what is the biggest mitzvah system? Okay, ask another religion. Well, what's the main thing about your religion? Believing that a certain individual that lived 2,000 years ago was the creator of heaven. That's it. That's all. That's it. Ours was business of learning Torah lishma. Studying beyond appreciating learning without a goal. That's chachmas atah. We have, that's really the essence of our whole religion. And that's why when you guys have an opportunity, this is a different opportunity than the world of technology out there. But we don't say the world of technology out there is, we don't negate it, we embrace it, we give sure. And we say that that's only good if you have this, because if you want to have a really good life, you must have this basis. And on this basis, everything's worthless. Everything's a means. But a means has no value if there's no end to it. So everybody realizes that practically, when it comes down to it, in your real life, there's no real life.
What compounds the study is allow myself in the Torah of the point of what things actually took rather than the text, rather than I could do the same for encyclopedia, I'd argue.
General knowledge. Right. That's a good question. That's a good question. So See, the answer to that is as follows, that when we say knowledge, what we are looking for is a kind of knowledge that is satisfying to the human soul. It's based upon, it's not the same, there are a lot of things that are called knowledge, but what we are looking for is a knowledge that has to do with the essence of a person's nature. It's in line with the tzelem elokim, which we have. Now that is not, in other words, let's say a person spend their whole life in studying a cell. It's knowledge. But there's a tremendous limitation. They're not going to gain very many universals because it's a particularized knowledge. You spend your whole life studying the first book of Euclid. There's no question that you're going to do it. Yeah? But what we're looking for is a knowledge that is a certain kind of knowledge. A certain kind of knowledge where science plays a role in giving us certain insights and certain universals. But those universals are really what we're after, not the particular so much as the whole picture. It's like saying somebody asked me, or we discussed one time, who had a greater knowledge of the universe, Moshe Rabbeinu or Albert Einstein? And the answer is, as great as Albert Einstein was, you say Moshe Rabbeinu. It's supposed to be the whole, in the passage that when God says, Ani Aver Kol Tuvi Alponecho, Moshe Rabbeinu had that nevuah, so God said, I will bring before you all my Tuvi. So the Rambam says, what is Tuvi? What does it mean, my good? Tuvi, the Rambam says, is a reference to the first parasha of the Torah. Ayar Hashem Kito. So wherever in the creation, everything is Tov. That's God's Tov. Tuvi, God said, I'll show you all the ideas behind the creation. Basic, fundamental principles, so you understand. You see? So a person that understands the fundamental principles has a greater knowledge than a person that understands the details. For instance, you take a house. There's an architect, and then there's a guy that puts in the windows. Now, who knows more about the windows, an architect or the guy that puts in the windows? There's no question. The guy that puts in the windows knows much more about the windows. But what does he know about the house? Very limited. An architect has the whole picture. He doesn't know the details of the window, but he sees the entire structure. So we're looking for that kind of a knowledge, which really leads us very close, insofar as we can, to God, the source of all knowledge. That's the kind of knowledge. That's why, what is the ultimate goal? And that, you have that in the same bracha. Kulanu yod eishimecha. We know your name, alone beisel asecha l'shma. Those two go together. Two components. Learning and knowledge for its own sake. And what kind of knowledge? Knowledge that leads ultimately to knowledge of God. And that's why all the Nevi'im say, everything is Yedias Hashem, Yedias Hashem. Because that's the ultimate, that's what we're looking for. And that's what Avraham Avinu, Avraham's discovery was, that if a person is right in that idea, his whole life is right. If he's wrong in that idea, his whole life has to be wrong. That's why Avraham Avinu is so terrible. Why is Avraham Avinu so terrible? Because you're wrong with regard to the most important piece of knowledge that you can have, and that is God. That's the most important. So therefore, everything revolves around that. For instance, a Christian who's just worried about hell or heaven, going to hell, his whole life's going to involve. Everything does involve around that. At the end of his life, it's like Billy Graham one time said, he said, well, what do you expect when you go to heaven? So he said, he expects Jesus to give him a pat on the back and say, you did a good job. See? And his whole life revolves around this infantile idea, which is so childish. It's like unbelievable. It's all he wants is a pat on the back. And his whole life, everything he does, revolves around that one idea. Because he has this erroneous notion. You see? That's why you have to say, a life like that is wasted. You can sum up people's lives in one term. Because you can see what they're after. And that's why his whole discovery was to show that you believe in these gods, and you're giving your children your lives for this, but this idea is false, your whole life is worthless. Well, let's try to analyze, let's try to understand, see if we can get the true idea of God, or insofar as we're capable of an idea of God. And that's the whole Torah. That's called the whole Torah. And that's the kind of knowledge that we're after. It's a certain kind of knowledge. It's not a knowledge of a specific branch of science. It's a knowledge that's based on principles that pervade all of science and all of knowledge, and to be able to apply it to the knowledge of God. The one that approached it the closest of any human being that I know of that didn't have Torah was Albert Einstein. His concept of God was very, except for the fact that, you know, he believed Scott Lunchman, he had no proof of that, but his idea of God was the same, basically, as Lennon describes. The concept of a being that's the source of all the chachma, of all the wisdom. He says every person that's a real scientist knows that there's something behind, the being behind this that is far superior to anything that our little intelligence can figure out. And that is the person that succeeded in that type of a thing. And that's really what Yahadis does for every person, is it makes that same road open. And then Albert Einstein is one in billions. But the Torah gives that opportunity to every human being, on his level. And that's what makes a person's life worthwhile. It gives them happiness and joy, and makes his everyday existence something that they look forward to, and something that has excitement and enjoyment. And that's really Rome based on Sacha Lashma. That's what everyone, that's what you have to understand, that the ones that wrote these brachos, these tfilos, the Gemara says, are not only the greatest chachomim, but there were many nevi'im there, that wrote the tfilos. The tfilos are the most unbelievable thing. If you understand, if you be zocher, and you'll be fortunate, later in life to continue, you'll see when you start understanding, when you really reach, if you reach a certain level of learning, you'll reach a level of understanding the tfilos. The tfilos are so deep, it's shocking when you realize how, what kind of depth there is. But just this one little bracha, you can see right away how these two things are put together. Yodei Shinecha, Lom Yisarasa. That's those two things. That's the whole philosophy of Yadis. You can sum up those two terms.
How do you want some intellectual
exercise to experience? That's a good question. See, the first thing you have to do, there are stages here. Like I said before, you can't jump. The first stage is to master the method of Torah Shavalka. The methodology and the thinking of Torah Shavalka. Because that's the kind of thinking that a person has to really be able to do. And it's funny, you know, well recognized. Someone told me, Hillary Clinton, met with the Jewish group, and they asked that question. They said, oh, that sounds like a Talmudic kind of question. So the world does recognize that there is a Talmudic thinking. And they don't know what it is, and a lot of people that learn Talmud don't know what it is. But there is a method of Torah Shabbat. You must master that method of thinking, because that really, it gives you a whole a world of a whole ability and a mystery of how to think in general, not just in Torah, but in every area. It gives you an insight into every subject you'll take. It will help you. So you must, it will give you a certain perspective.
That's beyond logic.
What?
That's beyond logic.
Yeah, it's beyond logic. Because see, logic, let me tell you, logic is not the same thing as creativity. Now, has nobody ever came up with an idea because of logic. Logic is just rules. Creativity, and some of the biggest discoveries were made by people that weren't magicians. And magicians is a field in itself, logic. You know what I mean? Einstein didn't come up with his theory because he's a magician. He's a creative mind. So the logic is the hardware, you see. But using the hardware is the mechanic is more important than the hardware. Of course, if you have bad hardware, you're going to botch up a job. But that's why you have no logic. But logic is not really where it's at. It's behind the logic. The creative glance. To be able to see something in a creative way, creative process. That is really where it's at. Of course, you know, if you don't have logic, your creativity can go awry. But the creative process is where it's at. So that's what you get from logic. Learn Gemara properly, you're really working with the creative process. That's what you're engaging. And that's what you're really going to begin. That's what you're going to begin. And that creative process you can apply to every area. So that's why it's something which will stand by you and anything you do, and I give you a certain focus that you cannot get without it. When I say you cannot get without it, I'm not saying it's impossible for a person to get without it. You can't, because it's a human thing. Avraham Avinu wasn't taught it, he had it on his own. Okay? And the Rambam says that if you understand Aristotle properly, you'll see he had that same method of thinking as well. But he arrived at his own. And if you understand, a great thinker also uses the same thing. You'll recognize it in what they mean. You'll recognize it in the way they approach a subject. Give me that book, man. Just pass me that book. Yeah, thanks. I'll show you something that I was reading. And I know nothing about economics. I guarantee you. Practically zero. And I was reading about this fellow. I just happened to pick up the book, I was reading about this fellow, William F. Sharp, who was telling me why he won the Nobel Prize. And he was saying that it's all luck. So I'll tell you the truth, it's all luck. He says, there were so many decisions in my life, and so many things that happened, that sometimes I break out in a cold sweat, thinking if I would have made a decision when I was younger, I never would have gotten near this, But one of the things he says that was a variable factor in directing him towards his success in this area, was that he had a certain teacher. And the guy's name was Armin Alcy. Okay? And he writes here, I'll just read you a few sentences. He says, he started the course by asserting that 95% of the material in economic journals was wrong or irrelevant. Okay? And then he says, he then proceeded to discuss the economics of the illegal market for buying babies. Okay. Now, so this. At one point, he spent 5 of 6 lectures wrestling, somewhat unsuccessfully, with the meaning of profit. Okay? Indeed, most of his classes had the characteristics of a wrestling match. We witnessed a brilliant mind grappling, usually very successfully, with the most difficult concepts in economics, in thoroughly creative and innovative ways. See? There could be no better training for a fledgling theorist and no higher standard. After 2 semesters with Armin Alcyon, I was hooked. I wanted to be a microeconomist. You see? Now, when I read these words, as I said, I know nothing about economics, but I can tell you, I know what he's talking about. The creative process. I know he's talking about how everybody's in economics and they can have all kinds of mathematical equations here, and this guy is studying what do we mean by profit. He's doing 5 lectures on a simple term because he knows where it's at. It's understanding the basic concepts that's really important. His mind is focused in a creative manner, you see, and that is a great, that's the same thing, that's exactly what Torah gives a person. These are rare individuals. Again, I don't know if this guy from one day, I probably will win the Nobel Prize, this guy. Because he's a theoretical, he's a thinker, he's a real thinker. But he, and a guy like, most of the time, the guys that are really the most abstract thinkers are often overlooked. Because, they're not interested in really showing off their knowledge or writing books a lot of times. They're just interested in the knowledge itself. And that's the kind of guy that he's describing. But this guy chooses his life. And was responsible for his success. So that's what I'm trying to tell you is that those people are very rare out there. You can get to that. That's a total way of thinking. You can get to that, and there are individuals out there, but they're very, very rare. You don't have many of those, many Armin Alcyons out there. You have more Nobel Prize winners. That's already a second level down. It's not as high as this guy. But the Torah will give you the introduction into the highest level. That's the opportunity to have a learning Torah. And you must have that. If you don't have that, you really have nothing. And that's the importance of learning Gemara. Because that's all in the methodology of Tosh about that. That is what it's at. And once you get that, then you have the process, then you can start applying it. And you'll see that when you apply it, you'll look at it differently. You'll be like that guy. You may spend days thinking about what profit is, and people say, you're wasting your time, what do you know?